Relatable. Relatable content right here, Kirsten.
Yeah, we need a support group.
Hello and welcome to the WPHP Monthly Mercury, the podcast for the Women's Print History Project. The WPHP is a bibliographic database that collects information about women and book production during the 18th and 19th centuries. My name is Candace Sharon.
And I'm Kate Moffat.
And we are longtime editors of the WPHP and the hosts of this podcast. This season, we have some exciting special guests to interview, new research to share, and more stories to tell. Join us every third Wednesday of the month to learn more about the history of women's involvement in print.
The Women's Print History Project is a big project. Its scope covers an entire century, multiple countries, and women in various roles in the book trades. Its size and scope is made possible by other, smaller, and more targeted projects. We've talked a bit about some of these sources in past episodes, especially episode 6, Mind the Data Gaps, but what we haven't talked about are the relationships that we've fostered with other projects during our work on the WPHP, and how those relationships have impacted how we collect and create data.
Dr. Kirsten Luner is the director of one of those projects, the Stainforth Library of Women's Writing. Over the course of our first season, we talked a fair bit about our title records and our firm records and the processes of creating and maintaining those in a fair amount of detail. Our person's records have gotten a little less attention, but they've gone through similar updates and adjustments, many of them inspired by Kirsten's work on identifying the women writers named in Stainforth's catalog. When the WPHP began, we had 7 fields in our person records: first name, last name, title, date of birth, place of birth, date of death, and place of death. Our current person records have evolved to have 14, including links to their Wikipedia pages if they exist, an image, and their VIAF record. In particular, our addition of VIAFs, or Virtual International Authority Files, to our person records was a choice we made following a conference presentation that Kirsten gave, which has now been published as of last week as Restoring Authority for Women Writers, Name Authority Records as Digital Recovery Scholarship in Huntington Library Quarterly. She also very kindly gave us her data to help us clean up our person records, saving us months, if not years, of work.
So today, we're very excited to share that Dr. Kirsten Luner has joined us to chat about her project and her strategies for researching women writers. Dr. Luner is Assistant Professor of English at Santa Clara University with focuses in digital humanities and women's book histories of the long 18th century. She is Director and Editor-in-Chief of the Stainforth Library of Women's Writing and is excited about forthcoming articles in Studies in English Literature, 1500 to 1900, and Huntington Library Quarterly, both of which relate to the Stainforth Project. Tweet her at @kluner and ask about Stainforth, library catalogs, letterpress printing, teaching, or favorite trails and climbing areas. If you find a book with a Stainforth book plate, Kirsten would love to know about it. Stainforth on.
Kirsten's project, the Stainforth Library of Women's Writing, is an online bibliographical resource designed to encourage researchers, students, and bibliophiles to explore thousands of lesser-known women writers and editions published between the 16th and 19th centuries. General editors of the project are Luner, Deborah Hollis at CU Boulder, and Kate Osmond at Cal Poly Pomona. Stainforth's library includes women writers, collaborators, co-authors, editors, translators, composers, and bookmakers of various kinds. And his collection includes a large number of marginalized women authors, including poor and working class women, those writing about their disabilities, Quakers, Jews, women of color, children, survivors of assault, women who survived incarceration, and queer writers. The digitized catalog and its related projects, such as person records, the Book Hunt blog, and teaching page, demonstrate not only how many women who published have gone unnoticed, but also how narrow the frame is that scholars have historically applied to the panorama of women's writing, and how much wider we can spread our curiosities and studies in the field. So So Kirsten, welcome, and thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us about your project. We just want to start off with a super basic question, which is, who was Stainforth, and how did you discover him, get interested in him, come across him?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me on this podcast. This is just an absolute delight to talk about Stainforth and to share my research on him and on his manuscript with a wider audience. So Francis Stainforth was born in 1797, and he died in 1866. And by profession, he was an Anglican curate. So he was a soldier first in the British Army in India before he went to seminary. And he married his first wife, Elizabeth, while he was serving in the cavalry. And they had four children together, a son, Francis George, and three daughters. And in 1827, his family returned to England. His first wife died in 1831. And then 7 years later, he married another Elizabeth, Elizabeth Ruffin. And they had two more sons together. Both were also named Francis. So there were three Francises in the family. And in 1828, he returned from India and immediately entered seminary in Cambridge. And then it wasn't until 1834 that he was ordained as a priest. So he served in a bunch of different curacy positions, but his last two, the ones in St. Pancras in London, and then finally he finished his career at All Hallows Staining in London. He was there until he died in 1866. And then when he died, his home, the family sort of had to surrender the home because it was provided by the state. So while he was a curate by profession, evidence really suggests that his passion was probably partly in the church, but also really was about collecting. And not just collecting, but also cataloging. So about, you know, both gathering physical items, but also documenting what he had.
Sounds like my kind of guy.
Yeah.
If you head over to Wikipedia, what you would first learn is that he was really well known for his interest in philately or stamp collecting. And he actually helped found the Royal Philatelic Society of London.
Ooh, wow.
And donated his own personal stamp collection to help create the first published edition of stamps in English. And that was in 1852. And he also, we were delighted to discover when we first started researching him, that he was wildly excited about shells. So he collected shells and mollusks, and was so into mollusks that he donated his shell collection to help create a guide to mollusks, edited by Lovell Reeve.
Wow.
Yes. And he did such a beautiful job with his donation to this guide that he has a mollusk named after him. So,
oh my goodness. Goals.
Right. So yes, absolutely. So this is all leading up to, of course, to say that, you know, he's a consummate collector and he really loves to catalog. He really likes the details, and our project has gone to great lengths to sort of document his collecting of women's books. So in addition to stamps and shells, which he apparently had in his house, he had over 8,000 volumes of women's writing lining the shelves and probably all of the counter space of his rectory in All Hallows Staining. And so he's got this massive collection of books. And just for comparison, there was an exhibit in the 1892 World's Fair, Chicago World's Fair, called the Woman's Library. And, you know, this is a World's Fair, right? Like, it's meant to be extravagantly enormous. And Stainforth's collection was either equal to or larger than that collection of books. So it's just crazy big.
Wow.
And in that library, we count 7,122 separate editions. And then also we've identified over 2,800 unique writers.
Oh, wow.
All of whom are women.
Amazing.
Yeah. So I got interested in Stainforth when I worked with his giant library catalog as a graduate student at CU Boulder During my PhD, I had a research fellowship in special collections to read as much as I could of the Women Poets of the Romantic Period collection, which is a collection of 500 to 600 books that they have in their collection. And the Stainforth Library catalog was included in this collection because it described so many of these poets.
Oh, cool.
And so one day I was just hanging out at my reading desk doing my thing, and Debbie Hollis, who is the director of special collections and who later came to be my first co-editor on the project, just brought this massive manuscript over and plopped it down on the desk, of course, very gently in the cradle, and said, "What do you make of this? We've had this manuscript for a number of years, but we haven't spent time really identifying why it's special, and you're a romanticist. That's why we've invited you to read in this collection. Can you help us understand the value of this manuscript?" And as soon as I dug into it, it sort of flipped the lid off the top of my head, and I was like, holy moly, there are so many names in here that I don't recognize,
right?
In this literary period that I'm studying. I don't recognize these names. These are all women writers. I don't recognize these titles. I had a hunch that not just romanticists, but also early modernists, long 18th century scholars, Victorianists, would really see a whole new view of our field just by looking at this catalog.
That's amazing. That is the best origin story. Okay, so you're looking at this manuscript or this catalog. Tell us about the catalog itself. How many books are in it? You've mentioned there's certain amounts of volumes. Do you know how many volumes there are versus books? And what kinds of information does it provide? What does it actually give you? You mentioned it gives you authors' names, which I find amazing because catalogs don't always give you full names by any means. We've tried to use them for the WPHP. Tell me more about this catalog.
So the catalog, to describe it in general, the catalog contains a historical picture of the field that really I felt was missing from existing scholarship. It's a collection of books that Stainforth valued and was able to acquire. Mostly 99% of them are by women writers. So it really shows what you could find in the 19th century. It's not a collection of books that a group of 20th or 21st century editors gathered and selected and decided to accumulate and publish in a bibliography. And one really interesting thing is that it also doesn't represent our current sort of presumptions about long 18th century or early 19th century writing, in that there are almost no novels in this catalog. So it's fascinating for those reasons. But sort of to give you the nitty-gritty, we did an editions count. This editions count was done twice because the catalog is as much as you can read it like a database, kind of. It's fairly regular, right? Each entry contains a shelf mark, an author name, a title, an edition number, or the place where it was published, which Stainforth also kind of uses to track editions, a publication year, sometimes a book format. As much as it looks super consistent, it's not entirely linear, and it's sometimes really messy, right? As manuscripts are.
Yep.
So we did this count twice to try to really understand the contents of this library. And so I have to give a shout out to Kayla Egan and also to Dana DeSopo, who were just magnificent counters in this project. So we have counted between our two tries at counting, we count 7,122 unique editions that are mentioned in the catalog.
Wow.
Yeah. And the volume number, so he does also say how many volumes sometimes are in that edition. So the volume number reflects what we were able to guess, right, or surmise by adding those volumes into the edition count.
Right.
But it's not as accurate as the edition count. The edition count is really what we can hang our hats on. And the catalog itself is 746 pages long.
Wow.
So it's
hefty.
Yeah, it's got heft. It is broken into two major sections. So the first 510 pages show the editions that we believe Stainforth owned and was that he was able to acquire and owned in his house. And then The last section is called the wants section. He actually writes that on a page, wants. Mm. And this is his wish list.
Wow, cool.
Oh, yeah. That's about 240 pages. And I have to tell you, part of the origin story of this project was after Debbie set this book down on the table in Special Collections, I was looking through it with another librarian named Greg Robel. And Greg and I had this amazing Indiana Jones moment where... So we're looking through the acquisition section, and then all of a sudden we get to about the middle or, you know, like the last third of the book, and the writing is upside down. And we were like, what is this? And we thought we had found, you know, some, we found like this really secret, you know, book within a book, but it turns out it's just a, it's a tetbesh, right? So it's a head to toe book. So the acquisitions, if you flip through the book, when you get to page 509, you get to the end of the catalog of books that he collected. But if you turn, if you flip the book over and turn it around so that the back cover is now the front cover and it appears to be upside down and you open it, you have like a new title page.
Wow.
And it gives you, it tells you his wish list. And so his wish list also in Stainforth style is sort of organized into sections. So he broke it down into British writers, American writers, plays wanted, and literary annuals. So we know even from his section titles that he was interested in both the writers or the people behind these books, and he also was interested in genre, right? Genre and form. So yeah, so that's kind of a basic physical description of the catalog.
Wow. Awesome. It sounds amazing.
Imagine just having someone hand that to you as a gift and be like, have fun.
That's exactly what it was like. It was really, and this of course, you know, as you both know, as we all know, when you have a good relationship with a special collections librarian, they know what you're interested in and they can point you to things that you never would have found otherwise. And it just becomes this really sort of brilliant collaboration. And then, you know, add people who are curious and who have great senses of humor. And, you know, all of a sudden, like, all hell has broken loose in Special Collections.
Which is what we always want.
We all needed to be shushed heavily that day.
So you mentioned that there's not very many novels in this catalog, that you encountered it because you were looking specifically at Romantic women's poetry, and it was part of that collection. So what genres, besides poetry, obviously, do we find in the catalog?
So it's heavily populated by poetry, nonfiction prose, spiritual writing of many kinds, drama, lots of drama, and travel writing. I would say that's, yeah, those are some of the major descriptors. There's also quite a bit of children's literature in there. Oh. And the children's literature is fun because, and you can find a lot of these books just by fiddling around in Google Books. You know, they have these wonderful illustrations. That's where you see, you know, a lot of color entering into books. So really the variety of genres is very wide. And we have this perception, I think, that, and maybe I'm wrong, but there is sort of a prevailing perception that 18th century writing, at least the stuff that we see popular, like Mary Shelley and Jane Austen, is fiction, right? And there's this whole universe of poetry and spiritual verse and nonfiction that women were, and epistolary writing that women were producing, that Stainforth cataloged, and none of these names look familiar, and none of these titles look familiar, but if you let yourself fall down the rabbit hole of researching them, you're in this whole other world that I feel like our field just sort of, you know, like, it can't see the periphery, it can't see it, right?
Yeah.
It's really neat.
Yeah, that's definitely what we found working on the WPHP, too.
Absolutely.
There's a lot more than just the fiction.
Yeah.
Thousands and thousands and thousands.
And as soon as you start looking, you find more and more and more and more and more. Like, they lead to each other. And it's just like a massive, a massive world opens up so long as you find the door in, right?
Yeah. Well, and I also wanted to add that going along with the WPHP authorship, we think that the way that Stainforth interpreted authorship was really, really wide, and it encompasses everything from editing to someone who was a translator to someone who wrote music to someone who collaborated on a musical production with their husband, and they wrote the score, and their husband wrote the text, and their students performed it. Mm-hmm.
Wow, that's really cool.
Yeah, and there are also, you know, we found evidence of women printers who were in this collection. So it's a very, very broad conception of authorship. And another thing, too, is that he also really celebrates collaborations. So if there is a case where, two writers work together and one was a husband and the other was the wife, like, it's still included, even though there's a male author in there. And he records the male author's name. It's not solely a women's bibliography. There are collaborations among sisters, and he always records both sisters, and sometimes will go out of his way. There'll often be one sister that's well published and another one that's not as well published, but he'll get them both in there with their own separate records in some way. So it's really interesting to see the lengths that he goes to show breadth, right? If that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, that does. So that's an interesting question in terms of how you are handling all these different types of people and relationships. And I want to come back to the people that you've identified in this database in a second. But first, I just want to do one more question about the catalog itself, which is that on your website, you have a TEI encoded digitization of the catalog, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes.
So I was just wondering if you could speak a little bit about the process of digitizing that, transcribing it, creating the TEI markup. So like, what kinds of decisions did you have to make while doing that? And why did you think that was an important thing to make available?
Oh my goodness.
Sorry, big question.
No, it's okay. So one thing I want to emphasize about this project is that it has been in progress since 2013. So yeah. When you ask what decisions we made, I can't even begin to list them. I can sort of categorize them for you, but we have a 7-year-old Slack feed that sort of documents all of them. And without that record, which Slack is currently holding hostage, and I have to pay them to get some of our data back. So this is another thing that we've learned in this project is how important documentation is, right? Because these projects just go on for so long, they never end. New things come up all the time. And the number of questions that we ask and that we actually solve are probably pretty few. The number of questions and problems that we've encountered that we document and hold for later for when we either have the means or the bandwidth or the people or it's the right time to address them. Like maybe we're not working on that part of the project right now, right? Like that's just not what we're doing right now. We're doing something else, but we're brainstorming and collaborating. And so you're generating all these wonderful ideas and you've got to write them down or they're just gone, right?
Yeah.
Relatable content right here, Kirsten.
I know I am among friends. So the kinds of questions that we encountered specifically relating to the TEI were originally, and this is really basic, but I think everyone who has a big project who's thinking about TEI and coding it should ask yourself, do you really have to? What do you gain from doing this, right? And for us, it was really important because what we have here is a catalog that we want to facilitate searching on. And by adding that infrastructure, that tagging infrastructure, it will enable us to make this data more searchable, more accessible, more combinable with other projects, more legible to other scholars. It will help preserve it. It was really important for us to maintain not only the content, but the structure of Stainforth's catalog. And our goal from the get-go, and we sort of got, we're really close to getting there, was to have it edited and searchable by 18th Connect. It was always one of our goals, and we submitted it for peer review to 18th Connect last summer. So hopefully that's not in the distant future. So again, that's, you know, we decided very early on that TEI encoding was important to us for all of those reasons. Now, once we decided that we were going to do that, we had to find a way to sort of bend the TEI to our will, because it doesn't naturally want to make bibliography entries. It doesn't want to do it. They're not paragraphs. We had to find a way to encode these units inside of which there were bibble or BIBL bibliographical entries repeated over and over and over. And that was really tricky. We did find a way how to do it, but it was really hard. And so I'm really proud of what we've been able to do. We also, with the TEI, I used it as an opportunity to list all of our editors, right? Just make sure that we use that as a way to document everyone who's contributed to the project, use it as a way to describe the manuscript. And that's also where you'll find all of our person records, all of the data that editors have added to describe the people that are in this catalog. And right now, in fact, the TEI file is the best, it's one of the best ways to see everything that's in this catalog in a structured and searchable way.
It sounds fantastic.
What kinds of things have you tagged in the TEI? Like, so you have people, I'm assuming, titles.
Yeah. So we tagged everything. So one thing to understand is that, so every project has to have a mission and a limit, right? And so our primary mission and limit is to describe the catalog proper. That's the heart of this. We're not trying to recreate like Orlando. We're not trying to do what the Women's Print History Project is doing. Like, we are sort of building a TEI file in a database that describes the catalog. So we've tagged, every entry is marked by its page number and its line number. And then we transcribed the entry. We've tagged the shelf marks so that we used those tags to reproduce a model of the library sort of organized by shelf mark.
Ooh.
We tagged names. We tagged, so there's the transcribed name and then there's the editorial name, right? So those will be different because sometimes Stainforth made mistakes, believe it or not. We tagged dates. We tagged the editions. We tagged publication year, publication place. I'm just scrolling through our TEI to sort of cue myself while I'm answering this question. Let's see. There's place name. We tagged formats. So all kinds of things. And you can see all these fields, actually, if you go onto the website, stainforth.su.edu, and you search and you click on the advanced search form, you can see all the different things that you can search under. All those are things that we've tagged. So that's part of how this is related to the GUI, right? The user interface.
Yeah.
I am fascinated by how much information is in the catalog. Like, I am so astonished because we've tried so many times to use catalogs for the WPHP, but so many catalogs that exist have like very limited information. It gives you the format, the price, three words of the title, and maybe a last name of the author.
Well, and this isn't to say that Stainforth reliably provides all the information that you want, right? So each of these titles is often an abbreviated title. If you compare the titles in his catalog with the titles in, say, WorldCat, you get two very different answers, but there is enough in his title for you to recognize what it is.
Right.
9 times out of 10. Another thing that we've tagged that I'm kind of proud of and that looks really cool in our user interface is the cross-references.
Ooh.
So he has, I can't remember the number, but it's in our, I blogged about it. He has a huge number of cross-references, and we went and sort of encoded those in the TEI so that you could see in his records which names and which titles he took the trouble to create a cross-reference to and what the target is. And then on the actual HTML page, those are hyperlinks so that you can sort of follow his cross-reference in the manuscript to see where it leads you. And we have found all kinds of cool things just by playing around in the cross-references. We've right? So we've found authors that, you know, that were research rabbit holes. I found with my research assistant at the time, Dana DeSopo, I found the book that I'm currently writing an article on. They're a really generative, sort of playful space to investigate what Stainforth's brain was up to. So there's a lot in our encoding. It looks, again, when you look at the catalog, it looks very linear and very structured and straightforward, but it's more complicated than it appears at first. And it really is sort of, if you let yourself be curious with it and play with it, you're going to find yourself discovering names and titles and having questions that you never thought you'd find yourself asking, no matter what field you're in.
Amazing. So you just referenced finding a specific book that you're writing an article on right now. And I remember, this is a very, very vivid memory for me, speaking of being shushed in libraries.
I know exactly what you're going to say.
Yeah, I remember sitting at a table with you in the Folger Library during the Women's Book History Symposium that we both attended in 2019. It was that one, right? And I watched you find a book with Stainforth's book plate at the front of it. And the librarians and everyone else in the room was not very happy about that find, but we were both thrilled. So can you talk a little bit about this process of using the catalog to track down the specific books that are named in it, but especially the specific copies of books that belong to Stainforth? And I mean, besides being really exciting and cool, what do you see the value of locating Stainforth's copies of these books as being? Why are you trying to track these down?
So first of all, Candace, we absolutely did get shushed, and it was like the highlight. It was one of the highlights, I have to say, that you and I would be in the Folger together getting in trouble over a book plate. And so the book I was looking at that moment was Thomas Bentley's Monument of Matrons. And one thing that's very true about this book is that when Stainforth's collection went to auction after he died in 1866, this book sold for the most money. It was the most valuable book in his library. It's gorgeous. And I thought I would never get to see it in person. And so, of course, I was, you know, doing a disco probably like 45 minutes before the reading room was supposed to close. And I called you over and you discoed too. It was very exciting. And there's always this excitement when you open a book and you find his book plate. So his book plate is really easy to spot. It's usually the way that we find these books. It has a shield at its center. And it has some stripes on the shield. And above it is a hand holding the hilt of a sword. And then below the shield, it says non-deficit alter, which loosely translates to not one fails. And so it's an allusion to Virgil's Aeneid and the description of the golden bough. So, you know, as the story goes, like when one branch of gold is torn off, another branch of gold will spring up in its place. So not one fails to replace the other golden bough. So I guess it's meant to say that this book is a golden bough and that, you know, it stands in for all the other editions of it. I'm not really sure, but it's
interesting.
It's an interesting thing to have on a book plate. Yeah. So I've looked at probably 200 of Stainforth's original books. We've found almost 400 of them. And he doesn't do a lot of annotating in them. He treats them like museum pieces. It doesn't look like, you know, they don't look like his house copy of Harry Potter, right? With dog-eared and, you know, it's been read to lots of people. It's not like that. They're really like collector's items for him. So I find that really fascinating. But so that's something we've learned about him by studying these books, right? By looking for the books that he owned, we learned about his philosophy of this library. Was it a library of books that he read and that he was very tactile and physical and material with? It doesn't look like it. It looks like he treated them like collector's pieces. And sometimes we can tell that he was also very, very interested in tracking the authors because he'll include at least I can recognize his handwriting, he annotates them very sparingly, but where he does, it's often filling in the blanks of who wrote it, or including a little snippet about a biographical bit about the author. So he's really interested in biography.
Interesting.
I have found in these books also, and there's one at the British Library, and Candace, you were part of this too. Do you remember when I messaged you and I found a hidden letter?
Yes.
By Stainforth in a book at the British Library?
What?
No, it wasn't by Stainforth. It was from an author back to Stainforth.
Wow.
So there, he does also treat them a little bit like scrapbooks. And the British Library also has some really interesting scrapbooks that he kept of author bios that he wrote, of author portraits. So it really was just a big, interesting, you know, physical material collecting project for him, and one very, very wrapped up in understanding the identities of the writers represented within it.
So good.
Yeah, and another thing that I really think is important about locating the books that he originally owned is to understand where they wound up, to sort of trace the life and the provenance of this library, right? So there's a book that we have in special collections at SCU by Celia and Marion Moss called Early Efforts. And using Stainforth's book plates, but also provenance in the book, we've been able to trace the book to the Moss sisters when they published it, to Stainforth's library, to a bookseller, the bookseller who bought it, James Westell, from Stainforth's book auction. One of the sisters who was one of the original authors of the book, Marion Moss, bought the book back when she was quite old. She was, I believe, 70 at the time. She bought this book. I'm not sure from whom, but she bought it because she wrote on the inside flap, and she wrote that this book was a gift to her daughter.
Oh, interesting.
On her daughter's 40th birthday. So it really is fascinating to sort of trace how these books move through the world, mm-hmm. who buys them, where they wind up. And then the way this book came to my attention was a book dealer out of New York contacted me because he found the website and was like, hey, I have this book with a Stainforth book plate that has a really interesting history. Might you or your library want to acquire it? And then, you know, of course, I promised all kinds of favors to our head of special collections, Nadia Nazar, and was like, can we please have this, please, forever, please have this. I'll give you any amount of dark chocolate. And she bought it. And so now we have this book, and I use it all the time to teach students about provenance, about the Stainforth Library. It's really fun. Thinking about finding these books, not only do you get to sort of inspect them for traces of Stainforth himself and for what his project meant to do, but you also get a sense of like what happens to these large private collections that are auctioned off in the 19th century. Where are they now?
That's amazing.
Yeah. So you mentioned that like his library was auctioned off. How was it auctioned off? Was it auctioned off as like in bits and pieces, like people could just show up and buy a particular book? Was it auctioned off in a way that meant like you could buy like a section of it that stayed together?
Yeah, did they try to sell it as like one collection? Did they try to say, here's Stainforth's collection, buy the whole thing, please?
To my knowledge, they didn't. To my knowledge, so as soon as he died, his collection became the possession of Sotheby, Wilkinson, and Hodge, the auctioneers, same as Sotheby's that, you know, you would hear about today. And they held an auction on the 1st of July in 1867. That was a 7-day, is it 7 days?
That's a big auction.
A 6-day auction. And there were 3,067 lots in that auction. So a lot is just, you know, it could be one book or it could be several books that they sort of tried to group together to sell. So they didn't try to sell it all at once. It really was sold together in bits and pieces that would be attractive to buyers. And prior to us, so one of the reasons why I undertook this project to begin with, the whole digitizing of the Stainforth manuscript, is because prior to our project, the only way to search and to know about this was to look through the auction catalog. So Gale publishes, and Google Books also has a digital edition of the auction catalog from this sale. and you can search it for titles and authors. And it's the search is kind of fuzzy. It's like not the best OCR. You can search it for what was in Stainforce Library, but the auction catalog gives a wildly different picture of Stainforce project than his actual manuscript catalog does. The auction catalog describes it as only female authors, only women authors. They use the term female. Really only poets and dramatists. And we already discussed that that's not the range.
Not true.
Of, right? That's not even close to the range of genres. And they also go on to say that it's a complete collection of women authors who published.
Interesting.
We know that it's not a complete collection because of his wants section, right? So there are items right. in his wish list that he knew about that he wasn't able to find. So
yeah. It's fascinating that they tried to portray it that way.
Well, and it's all because it makes it seem more valuable, right? Mm-hmm. So you're buying a piece of this complete collection if you're buying a Stainforth book or a lot or several Stainforth books. So I understand why they did it, but it really is a misrepresentation of the library and one that colors it just toward, you know, creating value for buyers at the auction.
As Kate Osmond would say, they were liars.
They were total liars. I was just about to say they were liars. They're absolute
liars. They were liars. Liars everywhere.
Yeah, they're absolute liars. So they needed to be corrected. And that's what our manuscript script does. Now, I will say that the auction catalog is useful in that it gives you a picture of what would have been considered valuable that was written by women writers at the time. So, like, there's a really cool book by Juliana Berners called The Guidebook to Hawking, Hunting, and Fishing that was a 16th century publication. It has this huge in terms of the auction catalog, but it gets a big chunk of the auction catalog. It's got like fancy typography. They really try to upsell this book in the auction catalog. But in Stainforth's manuscript, it gets a line. It gets one line, just like everything else, you know?
Interesting.
So it's interesting. Yeah. So you can see which books would have appeared to be more valuable. You also get a different view of how things are organized in the library. And then there is a copy of the auction catalog at the British Library that tells you what everything sold for. So that's fascinating, too, to see how much money was actually fetched for these items.
So, okay, and I feel like this is really interesting because we're talking a bit about like Stainforth's copies specifically, but I'm also interested in the fact that you're looking at individual copies to begin with, because that's something we don't do on the WPHP. We include one title record for each edition of a book. Even if we're able to locate multiple copies, we don't include multiple copies in the WPHP. But for the Stainforth project, it's if it exists in the catalog, it's part of the project, right? And I'm curious about how that structure for the project might actually allow you to include or allow for a different kind of data than what we're able to capture in the Women's Print History Project. Because, like, for example, I was browsing through the Stainforth project data, and it looks like he owns multiple editions of the same works. And so I was wondering if he also ever had, like, multiple copies of a single edition.
Never.
Never. Oh, so he kept track of this. He was like, never. Absolutely not. I don't care.
Right.
That's so fascinating.
Yes. He didn't care. He was like, if I get one copy, I'm good.
Right. It was about having the title, not about, like, I don't know how to say this, the material book itself, so to speak.
It's about the edition for him. It's about the edition. Mm-hmm. And so I have been pawing through this catalog for, you know, almost a decade now. And I haven't found him to collect multiple copies of the same edition ever. I could have missed it, but if it's in there, it's like a needle in a haystack. He really was interested in the individual life of an edition. Mm. And the sense I get from his catalog is that he was after collecting a run of an edition, right? He wanted every edition published by an author of a particular title. So the edition he collects is perhaps meant to represent all of the copies of that edition. What I love about this, frankly, is that it sort of gives you a new way to look at both the authors in his catalog that have tons of stuff in there, right? Mm-hmm. So like Afrobin, tons of titles. Hannah Moore, tons of titles. Elizabeth Inchbald, Susan Sontleeve, Eliel, really long list of titles. And there are lots more authors just like that. They all have long lists of editions in the catalog, but the interest becomes more about the differences in the editions and the number of editions rather than just on that title, right? And then I also found that one of the ways that Stainforth tracks editions is not just by number, but also by publication place. Sometimes he'll say, this is the Dublin edition.
Right.
This is the New York edition. And so you can really geek out on how many, and I've mapped them according to publication place. So you can geek out on how many editions by an author were published in the same place or in the same city. He does one really interesting quirk to note about his catalog that drives me bonkers is that he does not list publishers or booksellers. It's just a city. He just says it's just a city. So, right? So, like, I've got these things on a map and it's like wildly inaccurate because they're all just points on a, you know, it's titles and an edition number and a location in a city, but you don't know what print shop was responsible for that title, for that edition. You just don't know. It's just, you know.
Which is so interesting.
Yeah.
Because, like, sometimes the publisher is how you differentiate editions.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Like, sometimes there were six in London in the same year. It's like, the publisher is sometimes how you differentiate those if there isn't, like, an edition statement on the title page telling you that they're different ones. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. And the way that he does it. So, for example, Hannah Moore's Sacred Dramas is one of the ones that he collected just a gazillion editions of. So the first edition was published in 1782. Stainforth has every numbered edition through the 22nd edition published in 1820. He also identified a Chiswick edition, a Diamond edition, a Glasgow edition, and a Dublin edition. And the manuscript doesn't indicate that he's missing anything. And frankly, I trust it, right? Like, he's a pretty anal guy.
He was obsessive.
He's very obsessive.
Even about Hannah Moore.
And another example. So often these runs of editions, each one of them will be on a line, but there's an entry where you can kind of see Stainforth flexing, where he has a one-line entry for Fisher's Drawing Room Scrapbook. And he just says, Fisher's Drawing Room Scrapbook, comma, 1832 to 1849, which is sort of like, hashtag boom. I have every edition and a full run of the Fisher's Drawing Room Scrapbook.
I don't even need to tell you.
How you like me now. It's very rare to find a full run.
I love him. Personally, I am feeling very enamored of Stainforth right now.
He's great. So, yeah. So it just, it's really interesting to see where, like, what it sort of is a window into what his goals were as a collector, right? It sort of tells you what he cared about, what his project tried to do. So, right, another example where he didn't manage to find all of the editions, which sometimes happens to the best of us, it is on, you know, if you go to the website and you look at page 65, Fanny Kemble Butler has a book called Francis the First. And so Stainforth has a first, a second, a third, a fourth, and a fifth edition, a New York edition, but then he leaves a blank space for the missing sixth edition. Mm-hmm. And then you see below that space, he lists the seventh and the eighth edition. So he's left space because he's like, I know that sixth edition is out there. I want to find it. And if you use the search feature on our website, and you find the title of the book in the wants list in the back of the book, you can see that in his wants list, he lists, I need the sixth edition and I need the ninth edition. And he lists them twice as books that he's looking for. So, you know, he's like really peeved that he can't find. He doesn't have a full run of Fanny Kemble Butler's Francis the First.
I love that he leaves a blank for it. Like, he's literally making space in the page for this physical book that he's going to add. It's like leaving a spot on your library shelf.
That's exactly right. And it does make me wonder, Kate, about what his shelving really looks like. So we have not had a lot of success sort of using his shelf marks to understand his library better. There's not a lot of rhyme or reason to it. And I guess I would put it out there to anyone listening to this podcast, please solve this riddle for us. We've been thinking about it for years. And frankly, I've kind of like moved on with my life. So please tell us, you know, use our shelf marks in the database, in the TEI or the visualization that we have on our project. Please tell us what they mean, because we do not know.
Riddle it out. It would be amazing to be able to kind of figure out what his shelving situation, like to think about being able to browse that physically would just be so.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Well, so you can see if you go on our website, and I'll steer you there. Hold on one second. If you hover over the catalog and you go to shelf marks, you can see a visualization of what shelf mark A1, A2, A3, A4, A5, all the books that were on each of the A1 shelf, the A2 shelf. We've really tried to puzzle it out, and we don't know. And our programmer, Chad Marks, is kind of obsessed with this. I don't think he's given up yet, but the rest of us are just done with it.
So we've talked a lot about the books themselves that are in the catalog, but I want to come back to the people that you have in the Stainforth catalog and in your project. So a couple of years ago, you shared your biographical data with the WPHP, which has been a huge help in sorting out who some of these authors are.
Thank you, Kirsten.
Yeah, thank you. Saved us so much time.
You're so welcome. You're so welcome. I use the WPHP all the time, so the feeling is mutual.
So can you talk a little bit more about what role this biographical data plays in your project, what kinds of information you collect, what kinds of difficulties you run into in trying to identify the women writers that Stainforth collected?
Yeah. So one thing I'll do is I'll back up, because when we finished transcribing the catalog, maybe in 2016, and maybe it was early 2017. No, it was probably 2016. And we started thinking about what kind of data to add to that transcription of the catalog. You kind of have two clear choices, right? So you can either go toward the people or you can go toward the titles. And this was a sort of a high stakes decision because of the size of this manuscript. It's like the beauty and the bane of this project, right? It's just how big it is. So if we had to pick one, because we were going to do it well, right? And so we decided to veer toward the people first, principally because we could tell from studying Stainforth's manuscript while transcribing it, that he was so interested in the people. Like, that was part of his project, was biographical. Another reason was that we wanted to understand this goes back to your earlier question about what drew me to this project. It was all these names that I didn't recognize.
Right.
So we kind of just let that us steer us. And Deborah Hollis at the time was my major co-editor, and she was really into sort of learning about the people in the library. So that's just where we went. And we decided to set titles aside for sort of phase two. And I can say we've been working on person records, right? Adding editorial data about the people in the library catalog for 5 years now. And we were not able to research all of them. As both of you know, in DH projects, you really have to set your limits. You have to make your chapters. You have to define your project. Yep. No one is going to celebrate the end of anything for you. You have to say when a phase of the project is over, and you can't do it all. So after 5 years of doing our darndest to research some really obscure names, we decided to say we're done with person records. They've all been researched. The ones that we've researched have been edited. They've been edited multiple times, and that's the best we can do. I can say that in 5 years, we were able to make fully researched records for 1,469 people.
Wow.
It's a little more than half the names in the catalog.
Wow.
And so what that tells you is not so much about those 1,469 people, but it tells you that there are a ton of women writers out there who are really hard to research.
Yeah.
And research in a sort of authoritative way that I would feel comfortable citing in this
right,
work.
Right, right. We run into that issue too. It's like, I found their name. Do I trust this enough to recreate or replicate this data and present it as something like concrete, right? That someone else can trust and use.
Exactly, exactly. And you have to be able to cite your source, right? Like, is this a source that someone will go to? So another thing I can add is that in the 5 years of person record research on the names in the catalog, 25% of the people that we identified in the catalog do not have name authority records in major library catalogs to make them more findable. And a name authority record is a specific kind of library catalog metadata that disambiguates one Charlotte Smith from another Charlotte Smith, right? Like one person from another. And with women writers in particular, this is so important because they published under so many different kinds of names, right? So you might publish under your maiden name, you might publish under multiple married names, and then you're going to have pseudonyms. And then people are going to call you what they will on your title page. Sometimes you don't have any control over what people put on your title page, as the story of Anne Poyntz is, who I'm studying right now. So like a lot of what we collect for people, not a lot of, but part of what we collect for people are names that they might publish under or that they could be identified by. The display. So there's a display name, a transcribed name. We collect their authority record permalink, and we use the Virtual International Authority File, so VIAF. So we have the VIAF link, if there is one, birth year, death year, a role. So their role might be author, editor, transcriber, printer, score, someone who wrote a score, their title, if it's, you know, like countess, and then names, first name, middle name, last name, maiden name, other names, because you have all kinds of other names, pseudonyms. We also collect nationality, but that's kind of tricky. And I always sort of, I'm sure y'all have fields that sort of make you question yourselves from time to time. That's one of ours. And then below that, and I'm just looking at the fields that publish, we collect more than this, but the general notes field, I want to say, is where it's at, because this is where we say where this information was verified. So you could, and I'm looking at the record for Ada Isaacs Menken right now. And so in her general notes, we have verified in the American National Biography, in Cheryl Walker's 1992 American Women Poets of the 19th Century, the ODNB, and VIAF. And then there's a note sort of saying how the ANB and the ODNB entries appear to be wildly different for her, which doesn't surprise me given Ada Isaacs Menken. And then her Wikipedia link, and there's an image. So we try to collect, like we try to strike this balance between including editorial information to help describe these people without doing the Orlando Project.
Right.
And I can say that, you know, as editor and director of this project who has been researching people for years, the Orlando Project is a work of incredible heft and scholarship and critical thought and research. And we couldn't do it. We couldn't do it for all of our writers. And we're so grateful that it exists. But if we tried to do that, we couldn't sort of digitize and TEI encode and produce the accessible version of the catalog.
You have to make choices.
Right. So it's a choice. So these are the data that we include for the people. And I said, you know, we could choose between people or titles. And when we move forward and we do titles, each title will also have a sort of a record of its own that's kind of like this. And right now we're sort of going through the growing pains of deciding what information we will populate that with without trying to do WorldCat. We're not going to be the ESTC. We're not going to be WorldCat. But we will provide some editorial context for the title that's in the catalog.
I love that you keep track of, or that you actually capture the different names. That's something that we actually struggle with a little bit in the WPHP is like if it's like Frances Burney, for example, we have her in the database as Frances Burney, even though she was Madame D'Arblay for most of her life, right? So like things like that when they, and especially if they published under both names, it makes it difficult for us to decide because we don't actually have fields in our person records that allow us to capture that information. I think it's really interesting because married names and maiden names and Mrs. So-and-so and Miss So-and-so makes it really difficult sometimes to find them, to track them, to know what's theirs and what's somebody else who's also known as Miss Smith. You know what I mean?
Yeah, Yeah, I do. And really, I understand, you know, the challenge that the WPHP faces. It's very similar to our challenges of like which name gets to be in the display name spot.
Yeah.
And by default, right? So our project is about the catalog. So by default, we try to stick to the catalog. But when that doesn't make sense, we feel free to move away from it.
Right.
And we might go with what's in a VIAF record, or we might go with something else. Yeah, it's agonizing, right? Because you want to make this person findable. You want to represent them in a responsible way, but it's so hard to know what that is. And all you can do is make your best judgment. And then if it's wrong, come back and change it, right? It's okay. It's okay to make errors. That's another thing that as a project team, I'm really proud of, is that we are transparent about the fact that, you know, we've done our very best to transcribe and edit this catalog, which is huge and at times really hard to read. We've done our best to be accurate, but we know that there are errors. We find them all the time. And when we find them, we fix them, right? You just go in and you fix it. It's okay. It's totally fine. We're all human.
More relatable content, Kirsten. More relatable content.
Yeah.
You're speaking to my life here.
So there's another sort of category of record that I want to describe, and we call it a short person record. So I talked about the 1500 something women writers who we were able to create researched profiles for. There's the other 1400 something who we were not able to research, and believe me, we tried.
Right.
And for those people, you know, it'd been like 5 years is a long time. For those people, we created short person records and we just based them on the information that we have from Stainforth's catalog. And I want to highlight why we did this instead of just not making records at all for them. And that's because for these writers, they're already hard to research. For them to not have a record puts them at a further disadvantage and sort of continues their lack of findability in relation to other writers who are very researchable, very findable. So I really wanted them, even if all we had was a name, to have a record and a placeholder for us to add information later when we found it, or at least to acknowledge this person was never forgotten, right? This person wasn't lost. I think it's really easy to do, and sometimes I slip too, but it's really easy to say, oh, these women writers were lost, they were forgotten, they're unknown. They're not really unknown, they're not really lost, they're not really forgotten, they're just really hard to research. And they're there, it's just that maybe they're not in our normal channels of research, and we have to learn how to look elsewhere for them. And when we are creating metadata for them and creating presences for them online, it's important that we not subjugate them even more to authors who are findable and who we can represent with data very easily.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So do you have any examples of like truly anonymous authors in the Stainforth catalog? Does he like have books by people who don't sign their names and he doesn't indicate authorship? Or does he always know the name of the person whose books he's looking for?
No, he doesn't always know the name. So if you... Okay. I'm not going to be able to pull a great example out of my head, but I will say that if you just start flipping through the catalog, one place to go to find these names that are completely unidentifiable is to look at the beginning of each letter of the alphabet. There are a whole bunch of entries that are just initials. It'll just be like EC, AB, AT, TS. And you're like, who is this? And it'll be, you know, 18th century titles. It'll be like poems. Yeah. By AB, and you're like, great. How do I identify that?
Yeah.
So it's just like that. And then, you know, you'll go into Google Books and you'll be like, oh, I think I found a poems by AB. And then you have to ask yourself this really hard question of, do you dare link this entry in the catalog to this random Google book that you found? You don't have any way to prove that this thing equals that thing. And so as much as you want to, you really have to sort of hold your own toes to the fire and resist saying that you found the poems on several subjects by AB, right?
Oh, God. Poems on several subjects or occasions.
Poems on Various Occasions by A.B.
I swear we have hundreds of these in the WPHP.
Yeah, chances are you did not find the right book. And then, so relatedly, this is not an anonymous thing, but Candace, it's sort of an interesting thing that we come across a lot, or not a lot, but we have several times. Authors with the same name who are related, who are not the same person. Oh. And they have yes. publication dates that are really close to one another. So
the worst.
I have two examples of this, and I'm only going to be able to remember one of them. But Alicia LeFanu.
Yes, her.
There
yes.
are two.
Yes.
Oh, do you know her too?
She haunts me.
I yes. think it's her and her mother maybe have the same name.
Or it was like her aunt
publishing or something. Oh, her aunt.
It's her aunt. Yes.
We do. We know who she is, or who they are, rather.
Yes. Oh, my God. So yeah. Alicia LeFanu and her aunt, right? So Stainforth even mixes the two of them up. One of her books that's by the aunt, he attributes to the niece or the other way around. But if we weren't careful and if we hadn't gone with the default assumption that they were different people, you're going to lose one of those people.
Yeah.
Right? You're going to lose one of the Alicia LeFanus.
Yeah. You're going to conflate it all together into one person. Inaccurately. Yeah.
Right. And that's mm-hmm. that's really dangerous. And for that, we're really grateful for VIAF, right? So VIAF is one of the things that helped us out of that pickle. It helps disambiguate these two different authors.
Yeah. And I think it's so interesting because a lot of the challenges you're speaking to, we're sitting here and we're like, yes, yes, these are issues we run into too. And I think part of that is just that, like, and you've kind of talked about this and we talk about it all the time. Michelle was laughing because she was re-listening to all our episodes from season one. And she was like, do you know how many times we say that databases normally don't account for gender? She's like, do you know how many times we say that in season one? Because databases don't account for gender. They don't. And so for the most part.
We just said it again.
There are some beautiful exceptions, but it's true. And I think that that actually, it ties in so strongly to so many of the things that you're talking about that we also deal with in terms of trying to find these women and untangle them from each other and, you know, discover them in the first place or like find their names and then, you know, be really upset that we can't actually find mm-hmm. anything more about them because they haven't been as well documented mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. looking for them in databases is really difficult because what if the other people yep. who saw them didn't make empty records for them to hold their place and now they're not, all these little bits and pieces that we actually do have about them aren't findable. We can't amalgamate them into something coherent.
Yeah, we need a support group.
And I think that really is like it's a gendered author issue, right? In that like it's not anyways, yeah, I know. It's very this whole episode has been like hashtag relatable content. I think that's gonna have to be the episode title.
Yeah. Well and one other thing I wanna add is so our method of locating authoritative data for person records. Because of the difficulty of researching so many of these women, we had to do it in a backward fashion. So I made up this method called the cherry tree method, right? Where really you start with things like that are, you know, the most amazing resources that we all know and love, the Women Writers Project, Orlando, right? Anthologies and the J.R. DeJackson Bibliography of Romantic Women Poets. And you go through them. And you cherry pick, right, the low-hanging fruit. Like, who are the women that we know? Who are the writers we know? We'll fill out their person records first. And then you move sort of slowly into, you know, more and more obscure, more and more niche bibliographies and secondary sources and tertiary sources to find new names that the earlier sources didn't find. And then, you know, 5 years later, you find yourself, like, not having any sources to go through, to look for, to identify women writers. And you're like, well, this is kind of, you know, we've done yeah. a lot of work. We've done almost the knowable set or the known set, the already documented set.
It is time to start Googling AB.
Right, right. And then, right. So
on the off chance.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I don't have any experience trying to do this work on male authors. But I'm certain that it would be different. I'm certain that it would be.
I work on firms mostly in the WPHP, and looking for men is a completely different experience from looking for women who are mm-hmm. publishers or printers or whatever. I find the women hidden in the men's entries, which is something I bemoan on like every episode, but it's because it's the bane of my existence.
Yeah.
And I think it is a very different, there's different documentation that's happened.
Yeah. And we do, so to double back because of your sort of mantra that gender isn't often recorded in databases, we do record gender in our database. We haven't been displaying it. We do have person records for men, but originally we weren't including their gender or their sex. And I was like, no, we need to include it because there are men in this library catalog. And I eventually want to add a search function on our landing page that enables people to search and find the men and search and identify the women, because I do think it's important to be able to distinguish between the two, especially since this was really, really a library dedicated to celebrating the breadth of women's authorship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. And on that note, with women's authorship at the fore, because that's what we're in it for, isn't it? Do you have any favorite women writers that you've encountered while working on this project? Who are they? What do you find interesting about them? Give us just, you know, our last question for this amazing interview that we've had, Kirsten, thank you so much, is tell us about your favorite women writers that you found.
Oh my gosh. So also, this has been so much fun. Of the people that I learned about, I have to say, one of the things that I love about this catalog is that, and you have, it makes you humble, right? So you're like, oh, I'm a romanticist and, you know, I studied the Gothic or, you know, whatever your individual niche is. It sort of forces you out of your comfort zone and you learn about all these names and titles that you wouldn't have seen otherwise. And once you start doing research on them, you're like, oh, other people know about this person, right? So it's a really great way for you to sort of see where your blinders are and sort of understand that the way in which that we're raised in academia, right, the way in which we're trained is so narrow, it's so myopic that, you know, before the last couple of years, I would not have heard of Afra Behn's novel Love Letters, you know, between a nobleman and his sister that I taught for the first time, you know, this past year. And I loved it. It was so good. And my students loved it. I didn't know about Asa Isaacs Menken until this past year. And actually, Deborah Hollis, my co-editor, she really is on a kick researching women of color in the catalog. And so far, we have not found very many. We've only found three, which is really pretty pathetic. So Ada Isaacs Menken and Plato, and of course, Phyllis Wheatley. But I learned about Ada Isaacs Menken and was just blown away about how sort of hard to pin down she is and how interesting she is and how eccentric. Talk about a person with a million pseudonyms and other names in her record. You know, the list is like Ada, Adelaide, Mary, Rachel, Adelaide, Dolores, Dolo, Ada, Bertha, Rachel, Ada, Isaacs, and on and on. And she's just, she was a performer.
Wow.
Yeah, she's a performer and a poet. And she had this really sort of eccentric personal life where she married musicians and prize fighters and gamblers and
hero.
The editor of the Broadview edition says, I think really tellingly, it's so easy to get caught up in the fanfare of the eccentricity of her personal life and forget about her amazing work as a poet. And so one of my students did a presentation on In Felicia and Other Writings, the Broadview edition, during my senior seminar. And we just found her poetry so dramatic. And just, you know, you couldn't turn away. It was really, really fascinating. So I loved learning about her. And again, this is not, you know, this is a person with a Wikipedia page and really cool pictures and lots of people know about her, but she's out of the, you know, the romanticist purview. And, you know, I also have to say that just Googling some of the authors and titles has led me to teach and discover all kinds of things in my classes that I never would have otherwise. So right now I'm writing about Anne Poyntz's book called Je ne sais quoi. And you learn over the course of this book that Poyntz really wanted, and on the title page it says by a lady, but you learn really deep in the letters in this book that she actually had given orders for her name on the title page to be by a woman.
Oh, interesting.
And she describes, yeah, and in the book she describes how to her saying that she's a woman represents someone with experience, someone who's not young, someone who is sort of really forward and powerful and sexual. She has a lot of sex puns in this book, so it was very juicy and fun to teach. But she is a firecracker, and I really enjoyed sort of learning about her. Esther Barnes wrote this poem called The Disengaged Fair that I taught on a whim one year. And Esther Barnes wrote it to respond to a real newspaper ad. There was a guy who wrote into a newspaper saying, I'm writing in search of a wife and she should be proper, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, I want her to be like this. And she wrote this poem in response to him that is so on point, Mary Wollstonecraft sharp. So yeah, so I have discovered, and I also discovered Hannah Foster's The Coquette, which also is like not a mystery, right? It's out there. It just is. It's usually cataloged under, you know, American. Mm-hmm. Never read it. It was awesome. Students loved it. So you just kind of, I think what the Stainforth has taught me is to be curious and to be willing to read new things and check stuff out, right? Just leave the safety of what you think 18th century, the long 18th century, and even the early 19th century is supposed to look like in terms of authors and texts, and see what else is out there, because it's not all, but a lot of it is wildly entertaining, teaches really well, and will also help you fill in the gaps of sort of your understanding of really what the full universe of texts by women writers looks like from the 16th century through the early 19th century.
We expected this month's interview and episode to focus on people. And then we got really excited about Stainforth's catalog. Part of that excitement stems from the fact that it led us to think more about the way that our different projects are structured, allowing for different types of information to come to the fore. Both the WPHP and the Stainforth project are driven by an interest in gender and print, but they have different organizing principles. As a bibliographical project that aims to track women's contributions to print, the WPHP is organized around titles. We spend most of our time identifying and verifying the bibliographical details of the books themselves. And while we do collect data about the people and firms involved in producing them, they aren't our main focus. By contrast, the Stainforth project is based on the catalog of a single collector, whose interest in collecting the work of individual women writers places those people in a central role.
Neither of these organizing principles is superior to the other. Rather, they arise because we have allowed our objects of study to speak for themselves and responded to them in kind. Kirsten's point about staying humble is an important one, not only because projects like Stainforth or the WPHP can highlight the gaps in a discipline's knowledge. Approaching a library catalog or an individual book or an entire bibliography from a place of inquiry and humbleness means paying attention to those objects of study and considering what they can tell us on their own terms, then responding with a data model that captures their idiosyncrasies and the unique knowledge they convey.
This has been the second episode of season 2 of the WPHP Monthly Mercury. If you're interested in learning more about what we discussed today, we've compiled a list of suggestions for further reading and links to some relevant entries in the WPHP in a blog post that you can find at womensprinthistoryproject.com. You can also find us at the WPHP on Twitter and on Instagram at Women's Print History Project. If you want to learn more about the Stainforth Library of Women's Writing, you can find it at stainforth.scu.edu.